Here we go. Mm-hmm. Welcome to Ink a Podcast, Play a Podcast, your classic turn one play. Is that it? Is that the take?
Oh, I feel like you like to, you go real, caricature.
Well, okay. Welcome to Ink a Podcast, Play a Podcast, your classic turn one play.
I didn't say act mad.
This is Ink a Podcast, Play a Podcast, your classic turn one play.
And now you're resigned.
So, this is our first episode, and we have a whole bunch of stuff that we want to talk about on this podcast. But for episode number one, let's talk about the very beginning of the game. The mulliganing, or the hand altering that you do, and also the inking choices that you make. Because I have contended for a very long time, those are the two hardest things about this game.
And I think that can definitely be the case. Really depends on your deck, doesn't it?
I guess that's true. But I think, you know, everybody's aware that this game is, you know, it's pretty simple to learn, I would say. Like, the rules of the game are not that complicated. But inking and mulliganing are going to be the two areas that are the hardest to know if you did wrong. And that's really agnostic of any deck choices, I think. But I think that there is something to be said about different decks mulliganing better and also inking easier.
Maybe the way in is talk about the curve.
Yeah.
I mean, because when you're starting the game and you're deciding what you're going to keep and what you're going to mulligan, it's really in terms of what you want your curve to be, right?
Sure, yeah.
As the oh-so-experienced TCG player, can you tell us more about the curve?
Oof. Okay.
Just so you know, I put my hands together and I bowed at you.
Oh, good. Yes. Everybody should genuflect when they see me. So, yeah. So, I mean, the curve, you know, TM, is a card game concept. It comes from Magic, like a lot of kind of things do, foundational things. But any game that has like a similar resource system is going to have a concept of a curve. So the easiest way is, you know, you have a one cost on turn one, you play a one cost card on turn one, you play a two cost card on turn two, keep doing that, you know, indefinitely until you can't, right? So, you know, because cards have a higher cost, or because better cards have a higher cost, you want to progressively play better and better cards throughout the course of the game. So when, you know, if you've ever looked at like a deck list and you're wondering, why are they playing 8 1 cost cards? You know, like the one cost cards aren't very good. They're not very powerful. It's because the idea of having a one cost to play on turn one is something that you need. Basically every deck needs it. Or else you're going to fall too far behind because you won't be able to answer your opponent's one cost cards. And the same is sort of true throughout the curve. You want to be able to answer your opponent's two cost with your own two cost, your opponent's three cost with your own three cost. And so when you are looking at your opening hand, one of the things that you need to determine is, do I have a good curve? Will I be able to play cards on the first few turns of the game? I think that gets a little muddled when you are playing specific decks who may be not playing on curve, so to speak. So you'll be able to speak to this more than I would, but if you're playing a Sapphire deck, you might not have the traditional curve that other decks would have, right?
It's definitely true. I also feel like it's a more specific hand that I'm looking for than basically any other deck I've played. So the idea will be to ramp as early as possible. So yes, I am looking for a one drop. I'm also looking for a two drop that ramps, which is fine because all of my two drops are going to ramp. But then because I'm ramping, that means that that three drop spot is kind of tricky. There's things there that I do want to have, but ideally I'm skipping that spot. I don't know that I actually said I've been playing Ruby Sapphire, and that's the one of the classic ramping decks. So it does make a big impact on my curve, basically because I'm going to be doing a lot of jumping. So I can't really plan much beyond like turn three, really.
Sure. Well, and I think, you know, I mean, that's true. Once you get past the beginning of the game and you have, you know, played a bunch of cards, you've drawn a bunch of cards, obviously your mulligan decisions are going to have less and less of an impact, right?
Of course.
But when it comes to your mulligans, you know, you should look at the curve of your deck. If you wanted to go back even further, that is to like the deck construction. So like a Ruby Amethyst deck is going to build their deck differently than a Ruby Sapphire deck, right? Because you were saying your game plan is to basically skip the three cost slot. So you don't actually prioritize having a three drop on turn three versus you prioritize having a two cost ramp on turn two so you can do your four cost card on turn three. So that's still the concept of the curve, but it is accelerated and kind of molded based off of your deck choice. So, you know, you have, if you want to think of like the mulligan decision as your first, I want to call it like a skill check, because it is the first decision that you make in the game, and it's almost invisible the impact that it's going to have during the course of the game, right? So if you think of it as kind of a level zero, you want to look at your curve. Do you have something to do on the first few turns of the game to set you up so that you can use that momentum to power through the rest of the game? And I think your Ruby Sapphire example is perfect, because if you do what you can to manipulate what the first three turns of the game look like for you, Ruby Sapphire is such a consistent deck and it draws so many cards that it really does propel you into the driver's seat a lot of the time. Those mulliganing techniques and decisions really impact the rest of your game.
Oh, absolutely. The number of times when I've not played something on turn one because I didn't get a one drop and my opponent is like, "Oh, you're screwed."
Yeah, it's, oh, I'm so sorry. Well, you know, I'm really interested. I started tracking my, like my win rate, you know, and I have this all this data from Melee, but Melee doesn't tell me everything. But I'd be really interested if there was some way that I have not the best memory, so I would have to really buckle down and remember these things. But I'm curious what the correlation between like games I have lost and games I have not been able to have a turn one play, because I think I lose a majority of those games.
Yeah.
And it's subtle, right? Because, like I said, your one cost cards are not going to be your most powerful cards, but they should be, you know, it's the foundation that you're building towards. In like Ruby Amethyst or in any Amethyst list, you have one cost cards that draw a card. You have Brooms, you have Diablos, you have Chernobog's Followers. They all replace themselves and they build a foundation for the rest of your deck. And so I think that there is a very high correlation on if you don't play a one cost card on turn one, your chances of winning significantly decrease, even if that's not obvious at the time.
Well, it might be dramatic to say, but not like playing it. A popsicle on my turn one feels like I'm losing three card draws. Because I'm missing...
I mean, it kind of is, right?
Right. I'm missing the playing the popsicle, getting a card. And then even if I follow the rest of my curve and make it to Flavorsham on turn three, I don't have an item there to get my two extra cards. So maybe I'm not even playing Flavorsham at that point, and then I'm just utterly askew.
Right. I mean, how many times have you done your mulligan because you haven't had a popsicle in your hand, you don't have one in your opening hand, and then you draw one the next turn? You draw your popsicle, you draw your one drop on turn two, and you're like, you're a little late, guy. You know,
yeah,
like,
what am I supposed to do with you now?
Yeah, you know, and I think in, like, different decks will be more polarizing for something like that. In Ruby Amethyst, you know, it's like, well, I'm probably just going to ink this now. In Ruby Sapphire, you're like, well, I'm probably going to hold on to it until I can get value from this at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, I do still play three cost items, or not items, cards. So, you know, that might be what it ends up being, is that I do a three cost and the popsicle, and then play Flavorsham on the next turn, but it still has totally disrupted my game.
And that's because the curve has been disrupted, you know? Like, yeah. And that's, it's really interesting because the concept of the curve did not originate at the start of Magic. That came about after Magic had been around for some time. But the concept of the curve is just, it's just math. It's just, what's that math called? It's like hyperdermic, not hyperdermic. It's,
I think you mean hyperdermic, like the needle.
Oh, sure. Because you're injecting,
logic,
mana. Hypergeometric. Hypergeometric? Is that right? That's a math thing, right?
I am a math person. I don't know what you're talking about. In
probability theory and statistics, the hypergeometric distribution is a discrete probability distribution. Anyway. So if we think of like mulliganing for your curve as like a level zero mulliganing technique, you can think of like, I would say you'd think of level one as like the deck specific technique that you would use, right? So in your example, you probably would not try for a 1-2-3, you would try for a 1-2-4, as long as the two is very specific, right? Whereas in Ruby Amethyst, I would try for a 1-2-3-4, and then if you're playing like Amber Amethyst Hyper Aggro, your curve is probably a one cost on one and two one costs on turn two, right? So even if you do have a 1-2-3 cost in your deck, your deck does determine what you are looking for when you're mulliganing. If you were to go one level above that, though, and I think this is the trickiest part, because the curve and knowing your deck, that is pretty easy to grasp, even if it takes a while to master. The next level, level two, would be mulliganing with the matchup in mind. So if level one was your deck specific, level two would be your opponent's deck specific. So what does that look like for Ruby Sapphire? Like what's your worst matchup in Ruby Sapphire?
Well, I've never been great against Ruby Amethyst. But probably that or a discard deck.
Sure. Yeah, so, you know, if you think about it, you make different mulliganing decisions when you are going into a blind matchup versus when you know what the matchup is, right? So if you're in the second game and you know what your opponent is playing, you're probably prioritizing different cards in that matchup, right?
Yeah.
So you can think of that as, you know, you have to take into account the previous levels below it, but you also have to take into account your opponent's deck when you're doing mulligan. I think your discard example was a really good call, because when we were doing the Bucky meta, right, I was playing Ruby Amethyst. And anytime that I went up against an Emerald Steel discard deck, I was always very, very careful about making sure that I had cards that drew me cards. And that was my mulligan strategy. If the card did not draw me a card, or if it was, you know, too expensive to be played on time, or if it was just like, well, there's no chance that I'm getting to this card before they discard it, I shipped it back because there were better things to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to think of what I've done in those same situations. The thing is that card draw is part of what I'm there for anyway. So, I mean, the most that I... maybe a little harder for Haversham than Haversham.
Haversham.
I just amalgamated. Flaversham than normal, you know, like maybe, but I.
Right.
I think that as far as altering my mulligan for another deck, that has been seen more against other Ruby decks for me, particularly ones who are playing like Flynn, because for my deck, it's turn four before I'm playing something that really has any sort of power. Maybe, right. Like, who knows what I'm doing on turn four? Honestly, at that point, it's what cards have I drawn? I literally can't say that I have a favorite move to make at that point. Because at that point, I'm at like six ink. And, you know, I basically have the options. So that is the normal gameplay. I can't wait till turn four to be playing something with power if they're going to play out Flynn on turn two. They're gonna get way too many Flynns off of me. So, you know, as soon as I know I'm playing against somebody who's playing a Flynn deck at all, you know, then I'm mulliganing for either a higher power card, you know, as simple as a Grandma Tala, who can handle the Flynn, or I'm looking for removal immediately. Ideally not the removal, because the again, that's going to totally mess up my curve. But then again, so does, yeah, so does Grandma Tala.
You have to brawl on turn three, yeah, instead of doing whatever, and you just have that like one ink left over you typically can't utilize. That's pretty bad. And that's playing off curve, right? So you always want to try to play as much as you can. And I think it's interesting. So, you know, it kind of leads into a different topic. And I don't know whether or not to classify this as like its own level. So I have it written down as level 2B, which is your mulliganing decisions are also based off of whether or not you're on the play or the draw, right? Because let's take your Ruby Amethyst or your Ruby Sapphire versus like a Flynn deck, right? If you are on the play, you do turn one, turn two ramp to three ink, and then on your turn three, you have a four cost card, right? If that's a Grandma Tala, pretty beefy grandma, that can check the Flynn. Your turn three is right after your opponent's turn two, where they played the Flynn. So you play Grandma on turn three, they never get a Flynn activation.
Right.
But if you flip that, where they're on the play, and then they play a Flynn, and your next turn is playing your Teepo or your Sail, they're going to get an activation off of it. So you have to change your mulliganing decisions based on whether or not you're on the play or the draw. Now, in that specific scenario, I don't know that, you know, that there is a way. Maybe you do brawl instead of ramping. Those sorts of decisions, right? You prioritize differently depending on play draw. And maybe the math didn't work out on how much ink you have. That's why I don't play Sapphire decks, because it's too confusing. But
yeah.
No, I'm a straightforward guy. I do 1, 2, 3.
I think on the draw with a two a turn two Flynn from my opponent, they're getting it at least once. Unless, you know, there was a period of time where I was playing Pegasus. The 3/1 two cost that, you know, was put into my deck for Flynn.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, but that's the consideration, right? Is if you know that you have Pegasus and Pegasus is the only answer that you have to a Flynn on the draw, then you are going to make different mulliganing decisions. Yes. based on that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Probably in any case where Flynn is not a factor, I'm mulliganing that Pegasus away. That is not my game plan. But as soon as I know what's up, like, this is what Pegasus is here for. Let's get this done.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like, if you're thinking of these levels, you know, you got level 0, the curve, level 1, your deck specific decisions, level 2 would be matchup specific, and then level 2B ish is play draw specific. You always have to consider the lower level when you are considering the higher one. So that just kind of compounds how difficult mulliganing correctly is. The reason I think it's one of the hardest, it is the second hardest part of this game. And the reason why I think so is because there is almost no feedback for if you made the correct decision. You can't, you know, go back and say like, well, if only I had mulliganed one additional card, right? There's just no way for you to know how that would have worked out for you. And so the only way to learn is by doing it over and over and over again and just trying it. And even then, you sometimes might make the correct mulligan decision and still end up losing that game there's just no way for you to know. And that's what I think makes it definitively the second hardest thing.
Maybe you just need a deck where you know what you have to have in your opening hand, and that's it. And if you have it, you're good. If you don't, you're screwed.
That's the appeal of like an aggro deck, right? You know, if you're playing a very aggressive, I am going to quest for the win as fast as possible, you know that, you know, your opponent's position in that game is to stop you from doing that. Your position in the game is to try to beat them before they can stop you. And so, you know, if you have something like that, then these mulligan techniques kind of get collapsed a little bit, where different levels stop mattering as much. Where, like, in an aggro deck, your best mulligan technique is, like, level 0 and level 1. You think about the curve, and you think about your deck-specific, like, what your deck needs. For an aggro deck, I don't know that you really care about the matchup, and I don't know that you really care about play draw as much, right? Because your game plan is very straightforward, and your game plan does not really change depending on the matchup and depending on whether or not you're on the play or the draw as much as other decks.
My limited experience with aggro is definitely, you know, when I'm trying to reach that level 2 where I'm like, okay, I know who I'm playing against now. What am I changing? Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing, because yeah, this is what my deck does.
The weakness of an aggro deck is that it is more inflexible, you know, to pivoting to a different role in the matchup. But the appeal of an aggro deck is that it is very good at its one singular focus.
Yeah, right.
And you have control decks that have to worry about kind of all of these levels, but you have the time that, you know, you have the time in the game where if you mistakenly mulligan something, the game goes on for long enough that you may be able to compensate with, you know, good draws or good plays or, you know, a little bit of luck. You may be able to compensate back any mistakes that you made at the beginning, because the game goes on for as long as it does.
I don't make mistakes. I'm just extending the game.
You just wanna play. Like, you just have fun playing, and so you're just like, you know what? Can we go to 30? Let's go to 30 instead.
Exactly.
That brings up an interesting point, which is kind of another lesson that I learned from Magic, which is this kind of classic concept of aggro versus control. And when I say aggro versus control, I don't mean the archetypes necessarily, like the deck archetypes, because you have these different deck archetypes that you determine when you are building your deck. So Ruby Sapphire is a very definitive control deck. Ruby Amethyst is too. And then you have Amber Amethyst, which is a definitive aggro deck. But those are different contexts that I'm using right here when I say aggro versus control, because every deck is capable of being an aggro deck, and every deck is capable of being a control deck. It just depends on what role you take in the specific matchup. So how you determine that is really interesting, and how quickly you determine that in the middle of the game is going to be one of the like biggest level up moments, I think, as a card game player. So let me ask you directly. When you are playing Ruby Sapphire and you are playing against Amethyst Amber, right? classic Amber Amethyst, playing Daisy Dux, playing Maleficence, you know. What is your game plan against that matchup?
I mean, it's always to get rid of their questers.
Right. It's to stop them from doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Right? So you have taken the control role in that matchup, and they have taken the aggro role in that matchup. But sure. Think about it this way. Let's say that you're playing against another Ruby Sapphire deck. What's your game plan against another Ruby Sapphire deck?
I mean, I'm usually still going for the control. I like the control.
Right.
But I can definitely see, like, I could see a situation where, you know, that maybe it ends
up... The cards just don't line up, right?
Right. And...
Yeah.
You know, I'm seeing the items and the... Maybe I'm just seeing a lot of blue and not a lot of red. Then I could totally go aggro on in a mirror match.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, like, think about if you had like an opening hand against the mirror, and let's say this is post mulligan, right? And it's just like it's like a bunch of Teepos, and it's a bunch of small Sisus, and it's a Popsicle and a Flabbershrimp, you know, like it's a bunch of characters and not a lot of removal, right? It's not a lot of removal. There's not a lot of controlling elements, so to speak. Sometimes you get dealt hands in a control deck that require you to take the aggro role. In every single game, there is going to be a player who takes the aggro role and who takes the control role. Now, in this game, it seems like it's mostly the person who is on the play has, like, the initiative to take the aggro role if they want it, right? Just by the nature of them being able to put out a character first, to quest first, those sorts of things. But sometimes it's not clear, especially if you are in, like, a mirror match, right? If you are in a Ruby Sapphire versus Ruby Sapphire, if you both take the control role, then you guys are going to get stalemated a lot of the time, and it's really going to come down to who drew the most controlling cards, right? If you did not draw more controlling cards than your opponent, maybe you should have taken the aggro role and gone underneath the control deck, because that's kind of the rock, paper, scissors of aggro versus control. If you think of like an aggro mirror, whoever is on the play is obviously going to take the aggro role. And you, as the aggro player on the draw, either needs to determine, I bet I can out aggro him. I bet my cards are quicker than his cards. Or my cards are quicker than their cards. Or the aggro player on the draw needs to determine, okay, they're going to be quicker than me because they're on the play. I need to disrupt them enough so that I can take back the advantage. So even an aggro deck has the opportunity and should take the controlling role, even in a mirror match.
I would say that that's pretty much the only time they can take the control.
Probably, yes, very true. But it's something that I think, I mean, like, I'm not the best at it, you know, but I think it's something that if you as a player aren't consciously thinking about it, I think consciously thinking about it is going to be one of the biggest level up moments as a card game player. Is you sit down and you're on turns two or three or four, and you have to realize what position are you in? And what is your role? Are you the aggro deck or are you the control deck in this game that I am playing? And making that determination will force you to do different moves, will force you to play different cards. But you have to make that determination. You have to understand your role in the matchup. And I think that if you do, you're going to be far more successful at this game.
That, wow. Honestly, because I am very excited to do more mirror matches now. Honestly, I always kind of enjoy them because I think I'm a pretty good Sapphire player. but
yeah, mirror matches, you know, they call them mirror matches because you're playing the same deck, but they also, you could also consider them as like holding a mirror up to your own ability to play that deck. And yeah, it is humbling at times when you think you're pretty good with your main deck and then you're like, oh wow, I lost pretty hard.
I definitely should not have said that, you know, especially going into a tournament this weekend where surely I'll see other Ruby Sapphires.
you say that, except you switched back to Ruby Sapphire for the last two set championships and you were like one of two people who were still on Ruby Sapphire.
I know. It's very interesting. Made me feel happier for switching.
So interesting how that happened. I mean,
that people just don't want to play the same thing as me. Like, that might be the whole thing.
That's what I was going to say. Well, because they know that if you're playing Ruby Sapphire, you are such a good Ruby Sapphire player that they're not going to win the mirror match. And so they need to choose a different deck in order to stand a chance.
Well, and they all switched to Ruby Sapphire at the beginning of the set to try and scare me away. And I'm like, well, I just want to go try some other stuff. And so I did. And then I'm like, nah, guys. Away? I'm coming back. And then they're like, okay, I guess they're done with God, it then.
Oh, no. Not Amy. Not Amy on Ruby Sapphire.
Oh, God, not her. No. Right.
Yeah. I felt really bad because I used to have a good matchup against your Ruby Sapphire deck. And then I changed to a deck that had a really bad matchup against your Ruby Sapphire deck. And That was pretty disappointing, the result of that matchup.
Yeah.
Both times. Two set champs in a row.
I know.
Two set champs in a row, we ended up playing against each other. We played so many different set champs together. Never played you before when you were not on Ruby Sapphire, and I had an amazing matchup against either of the other decks that you played. And then the two tournaments that you switched back to Ruby Sapphire, we end up playing, and you end up knocking me out.
Yeah.
So rude.
It was pretty cool.
It's fine. I'm not bitter.
Me neither.
Well, I think that was pretty good.
Honestly, I feel like I learned stuff.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. You know, like I don't want this just to be me waxing poetic the entire time. I want this to be
educational for anybody. I don't know. You did say holding a mirror up to yourself.
I thought that was a very nice sentiment. Thank you very much.
I mean, I'm definitely going to think about it the next time that I play a mirror match.
I think about it every time I play a mirror match. I'm just like, what are they doing that I would not have done?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I definitely do that.
You know, I'm constantly thinking about, like, as soon as there's a mirror match, it's like decisions that my opponent makes where I'm like, oh man, and you know, I'm doing that just as part of the game where I'm like, oh, I bet they're going to quest with their whatever. And then I can do this, that, and the other thing on my turn. And then they don't, you know, and they do something completely different that we're playing the same deck, and so I feel as though I should anticipate, and I feel like I do anticipate a lot of my opponent's moves, but when they do something different, I'm like, did they do a better move than what I would have done, or did they do a worse move?
You start being like, okay, wait a sec, that wasn't what I thought they were going to do. What do they have in their hand? Like, what is their three-turn chess move?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I like, that's probably one of my favorite parts of the game is deducing certain things from my opponent's actions. You know, like, it's, once you get deep enough into the game, and like, this is not something that you should be able to do right off the bat. But once you get deep enough into the game, into like the competitive side, there's really only a handful of cards that are competitively viable, right? And so, and then of those handful of cards, everybody's restricted to two colors. And so you sit down and you see somebody, they sit down and they ink a Chernobog's followers, or, you know, they ink a Brawl and play a Chernobog's followers. And you're like, cool, Ruby Amethyst. And you can deduce, you know, 95% of their deck just based off of the first turn of the game. And so there's a lot of, once you've played against a lot of Ruby Amethyst, you know most of their deck lists just by those two things happening on the first turn. And then you can start predicting what their play patterns are going to be based off of that knowledge. And so that's where things like, oh, well, you know, I'm actually not going to quest or challenge with my two-cost character because we're going into turn three, and they probably have a Madam Mim Fox. And I don't want to give them that free target into my character, you know, those sorts of things. You will do that naturally over the course of just learning the game, but you can extrapolate that out even further where you're like, okay, if they do Fox on turn three, then they're probably going to do this on turn four. They're probably going to do this on turn five. You know, and you can start figuring that out. And then you like, okay, well, they only have two cards in hand, so the probability of them having this specific card that I'm worried about is probably pretty low. And then you just, you know, you start making educated guesses. I think there was another tweet that I saw, and I'm sorry that I can't give credit, but there was a tweet that I saw that it was like, I don't know that it was about card games. I think it was about like Dota or something, but it was the best players are like, players are inherently risk adverse, and so given a shot of a 50-50 chance of this is going to go really well for me or this is going to go really wrong for me, players will opt to not take that 50-50 chance and instead take like the 70-30 chance of, okay, 70% chance this goes okay for me, and 30% chance this goes not great but not terrible for me. They'll take the safer route when the best players are taking that 50-50 shot every time. And they're saying, you know what, if I pull this off, I'm really far ahead. And if I don't, then, you know, that's bad luck, I lose this game. And so I think making that determination of when to take the 50-50 shot or even worse odds is really, really interesting. But I think that comes with time.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely, I'm not at the point where I have everybody's decks memorized, but I do, you know, pretty much know what's out there, you know? And I haven't played enough decks to know how each expects to play.
Right.
I'm really looking forward to, I mean, that's why I was trying to play more this time than just Ruby Sapphire, and why I'll continue to probably try other decks and then resort back to Ruby Sapphire.
Always come back to Ruby Sapphire. Well, and I think
it's my home. I think
there is yeah, exactly. Your comfort, your safety blanket.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of value in playing different decks, even if you eventually come back to the one that you are most comfortable with, because everybody has a different affinity for a different play style. Some people are just not in the right headspace to be able to play an aggro deck. Some people are not in the right headspace to be able to play a control deck. It is very, very deeply personal to you as a player, to you as a person, what type of deck you are going to be best with. But with that said, there is a lot of value in playing the other meta decks, not just playing against them, but playing them yourself so that you can get in the shoes of your opponents and say, okay, what's important to me in this matchup? If I am playing Amber Steelsong against Ruby Amethyst when I'm normally the Ruby Amethyst player, what's important to the Ruby or to the Amber Steelsong player? What am I not wanting to see on the other side?
Yeah.
What is very difficult for me to overcome? Because then once you go back to your main deck, you'll have that knowledge, that learned, earned knowledge of how to play your main deck. And I think that that's what we want to try with this series. You know, we're going to do these podcasts. We're going to do, you know, these kind of random topics about kind of evergreen things that span different card games, not necessarily specific to Lorcana, but they span different card games. They're lessons learned from our predecessors, right? Lorcana is still a pretty new card game, but there are still lessons to be learned from the card games that came before us. And what we really want is this podcast to be useful to not only veterans of different card games, but also to newcomers. Hello, Amy.
Hello.
And also maybe people who played card games before, but took a break and are joining Lorcana and want to get caught up on kind of what's happening with this game. Those are the sorts of things that we want to talk about on the podcast. And then we also are going to be doing matchup videos. We're going to be doing playtest videos where we smash two different meta decks against each other and talk through our thought process. And we are going to be learning alongside of you.
I am so excited for that.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's your favorite part, right? My favorite part is the talking. I just love talking about Lorcana.
No, the talking's awesome, but I'm really looking forward to playing basically everything and really becoming familiar with it all. You know, there's nothing better than playing it, I think. Playing against it doesn't do the same as playing with it.
No, it really doesn't. And so, you know, we're going to be learning alongside all of you. And we are, you know, we're competitive card game players at this point. We went to two of the DLCs last year. And we plan on going to more in the second season. So
oh, yeah.
we want to get better as much as anybody else does. And we want to use this as a way to, you know, share what knowledge we have, you know, what our experiences are. And coming from competitive Magic, I want to be able to share the lessons that I've learned from that game that cross over to this one. But, you know, like I'm not the best player. You're not the best player. We have a lot to learn. And I think the best way to do that is by, you know, just talking and playing.
Yep.
That's all I want to do. I just want to talk it together. But I think that's a good stopping point for this first inaugural episode, don't you think?
I think fantastic.
You're at like 12% battery at this point.
Oh no, I'm at 5.
Oh boy. Yeah, we gotta wrap this up. So yeah, thanks for listening. We have a whole bunch of social media stuff, but I need to figure that out first. While I'm looking up the social media, you told me off mic earlier that you thought that Bucky was going to come back unerratted. Do you want to give me your reasonings for why you think that's going to happen?
So on the Discord, everybody was talking about what you'd even call it Is it reratting? Is it deratted? There's no reason for them to talk about that if they aren't talking about Bucky coming back normal. So, I mean, the signs are all there.
You just gotta look for it.
You just gotta look for it.
Well, I'm convinced. So, yeah, this was Inca Podcast, Play a Podcast. If you want to find more, you can find us on the socials. We are at IncaPodcast.com. On Instagram, we are at Inca Podcast, Play a Podcast. On Twitter and YouTube, we are just simply Inca Podcast. We'll be posting content on all sorts of places. I think we're planning on doing different content on each one, so make sure that you follow us on all of them. And leave a comment if there's anything that you want to see in an upcoming episode.
Oh yes, please. We love ideas.
We love the comments. We love the comments, or at least I think we will. We don't have any comments right now because this is the first episode. I like the idea of comments. Love the idea of comments. And you know, if we get a healthy comment section, we'll read some questions off on the show and answer them directly.
And we are so willing to talk about what people want to hear about.
Yes. We like I said, we have a bunch of different topics that we want to talk about, but you know, we're going to need more if we're just going to continue this indefinitely. Anyway, that's our show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was good.
Yeah, that was fun.